Well, you've been through one examination, so it's time to start a new unit. The rest of the units, unlike the first one, will be three chapters each. The first chapter of this unit is the structure and function of large biological molecules, which we've talked about a little bit before, large biological molecules, that is, which are also called macromolecules. And there are how many categories of these? Four, right. What are they?
Nucleic acids.
Nucleic acids.
Proteins.
Proteins. No. Polysaccharides. Not carbohydrates either, because not all carbohydrates are big. And what's the third one? Our fourth one? Lipids. Right. Those are the four categories of macromolecules. All organisms vitally need all four. You can't live without any of them, without any one of them. But of those four categories, three of them officially qualify as polymers. A polymer is simply a many-part thing, which is what polymer literally means. Poly means many, mer means part. A polymer is different from another molecule that could also be big in that it's built by hooking together a bunch of similar or identical subunits, which are called monomers, one-parters. So I said that three of the four categories of macromolecules are also polymers. Which one is not? Which of those four categories is not a polymer? Yes, lipids are not polymers, although they are macromolecules. They're built a little bit differently, and we'll see some differences. The other three are, though. Proteins are polymers, polysaccharides are polymers, nucleic acids are polymers. I bring that up now not only because it's something I want you to know, and we'll talk more about, but because this opening slide, which is a general slide, uses polymers as an example, but that's just an example. The fact that it's polymers here does not matter. The important point on this slide actually applies also to lipids, not just the three polymers categories. And that important point is that cells need to be able to build bigger things out of smaller things, build up molecules out of smaller molecules, that is. And they need to do the reverse as well. We need to be able to break bigger molecules into smaller pieces. Cells are continuously doing this. The way to build bigger things out of smaller things is illustrated on the top. So you have two pieces to begin with, and they are just, you know, this is just real generalized. But you have two pieces that you want to link together. For this to happen, one of the two pieces has an H somewhere, a hydrogen, and another one has an OH somewhere on its structure. And each of those things is taken off of the chunks, an OH from one and an H from the other. And if you get those two things together, an OH and an H, you can make water out of it, right? H2O. And therefore, water comes out of this process. But think about this in terms of your molecular models, right? In order to hook two molecules together, you can't do it unless you take something out of each molecule to leave a hole in each so that you can bond them together, right? Well, that's what's happening here. You're taking an H and an OH from the two chunks. That leaves water, but it leaves empty holes in the two chunks, which can then be bonded together to form a bigger piece. And the particular kind of reaction that allows that to happen is named a dehydration reaction, very descriptively, right? Because doing that takes water out, which is what dehydration means. Some books also call it condensation reaction. Those are interchangeable terms, but that's not really as meaningful in terms of what's really happening at the atomic level than dehydration is. So dehydration allows cells to build bigger things out of smaller things. The reverse has to happen as well, though. So it's a completely reversible reaction, but the reverse reaction gets a different name. In the bottom, we see the reverse happening. This is hydrolysis. Hydrolysis breaks bigger things into smaller chunks, but it is exactly the reverse. Dehydration takes water out. Well, you have to put water in for hydrolysis to happen. And lysis, by the way, is a word just by itself, means splitting. Hydrolysis literally means water splitting, but you have to put a water in. The water itself gets split, but this allows one of the hydrogens from the water to get put onto one of the pieces to fill its hole, because there will be holes when you separate them, right? And the OH, which is the rest of the water, will get stuck onto the other chunk. Exactly the reverse of dehydration. But exactly the opposite happens. It breaks things down into smaller chunks. And so this is how molecules are built, basically, the big molecules that we're talking about for the rest of this chapter. If you think about the molecules in your own cell, those big molecules did not come in that form in your food. Right? The stuff that's in our food is what makes up our bodies. That's the raw materials for our bodies, but it's not in the same form. That's because it's whatever organism we ate, those macromolecules that are part of that organism are too big to put into our body, to put into the cells of our body, which is what our body is made out of. And so we say all the time, for instance, that we put food into our bodies, but we don't. I mean, not unless you inject peanut butter into your veins or something, which I'm not recommending you do. We don't put food into our body when we eat. We put it into the alimentary canal, the continuous tube from mouth to anus, which is continuous with the air around us, right? That's outside of our body. Our body's made of the mass of cells that surround that tube, kind of like the stuff of a bagel surrounds the hole, right? The hole is like the alimentary canal. And if you put your finger through that hole, you're not putting it into the bagel. Similarly, our food is outside of our body when it's in our alimentary canal. And we can't take those big molecules into our cells because they're too big to get into our cells. So while it's still outside of our body in our digestive tract, we have to digest it into smaller pieces so that those molecules are small enough to be absorbed into our cells. That's when it's finally in our body. It's no longer macromolecules. But it's the building blocks that we can then put together in different ways to build our own macromolecules out of those subunits using dehydration reactions. Hydrolysis reactions, though, are involved in digestion. That's not the only time, but that's an example. So that applies to all four kinds of big molecules, even though polymers are listed there. That's a general slide. The rest of the slideshow has to do with surveying one at a time the four categories, starting with polysaccharides on slide two, but slide two doesn't show you any polysaccharides. None of these examples is a polysaccharide because it's not big enough. Remember, polysaccharides are polymers, which the word poly tells you. The saccharide part of polysaccharide means sugar. And so a polysaccharide is a large sugar. It's a complex sugar, meaning that it's made out of many small sugars that have been hooked together. Those subunits, those monomers, are monosaccharides, and that's what we're looking at in this slide. These are all simple sugars or monosaccharides. Now, monosaccharides are complete molecules when they're by themselves, but they can be hooked together to form these bigger sugars. But they are all examples of carbohydrates. A And this is why you don't want to use the word carbohydrate to, as one of your categories for four biological macromolecules, because none of these is a big molecule, right? But they're all carbohydrates. But anyway, the word carbohydrate, I want to repeat, should not be, try not to confuse that with the word hydrocarbon. Hydrocarbon, I mean, it's kind of similar word in terms of their roots, but hydrocarbons have carbon and hydrogen only. Carbohydrates have carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen, which you can see from all these structural formulae, every one of these examples. The reason that they get this name, by the way, is that the general, these are all monosaccharides, and there's many, many more kinds of monosaccharides, but the general chemical formula for a monosaccharide is some number of N's, so CN, twice that many hydrogens, so it's H2N, and the same number of oxygens as carbon, so ON. CnH2nOn is the general formula for any given monosaccharide. But you can kind of simplify this, kind of like the mathematical distributive property, by writing Cn, and then in parentheses, H2On. Right? That's H2nOn when you distribute the N. But when you write it this way, it looks like it is part carbon and part water. Carbohydrate is why it got that name. Even though that's technically not what it is, but that's what the general, that's structural, I mean the general chemical formula for a monosaccharide is, and monosaccharides are the building blocks of bigger sugars. Sugar, by the way, is kind of a problematic term because some sources will say sugar only when they mean monosaccharides specifically. Others will call any carbohydrate a sugar. I'm among those, by the way, the latter. Any carbohydrate I call a sugar. You can tell from most names of carbohydrates that they are sugars by the O-S-E ending. Words that end in O-S-E are sugars. Now, not every single sugar name ends in O-S-E, but many of them do. And the table that you see here shows two different, fundamentally different ways in which we can classify monosaccharides. Fundamentally different meaning that the two ways have nothing to do with each other. The columns represent one way of classifying monosaccharides. And that's on the basis of how many carbons are in the skeleton. So notice that glyceraldehyde and dihydroxyacetone both have three carbons in their carbon skeleton. And as a matter of fact, they both have exactly the same number of every of the three atoms. So they both have exactly the same chemical formula, C3H6O3. And what does that say about those two molecules? What does that tell you about them? Yes, they are isomers of each other. And they're not the only possible versions. Well, for trioses, yes. But these pentoses all have five. So triose is not a substance. It's a category of monosaccharides, but it literally means three sugars, three carbon sugars, trioses. Pentoses mean five carbon sugars. Hexoses means six carbon sugars. And the higher the number of carbons, the more possible individual versions there are. The glucose that you built, for instance, is just one hexose, shown right here. It's not the only hexose. Anyway, that's one way of classifying monosaccharides, based on how many carbons. Well, what do you see is true for every one of these, regardless of what column or row they're in? Other than the fact that they're all made out of carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen, what else do you notice that they share?
Double covalent bond.
There is a double covalent bond in each of these that is part of what? Right. Every one of these monosaccharides, and monosaccharides in general, contain contains a carbonyl group, the one that are highlighted in salmon on this slide. But remember, if you think back to functional groups, there's two different categories of compounds that contain carbonyl groups, right? Because there's two possibilities for the placement of that carbonyl. It can be either at the tip of a carbon skeleton or not at a tip. That was the basis of the alphabetic trick I told you, that aldehyde starts with an A, and A is at a tip of the alphabet. Ketone starts with a K, it's not at a tip. So any carbonyl-containing compound is either an aldehyde or a ketone, and therefore that's true for all monosaccharides because they all contain a carbonyl group. And remember, OSE means sugar. So the rows show you that a different way of classifying monosaccharides is based on whether they are aldehydes or ketones. All of these have their carbonyl at a tip, so they qualify as aldoses, aldehyde sugars, whereas the ones on the bottom are not at a tip, so they are all ketoses or ketone sugars. These are, well, this glucose is the version that you built. I say version because there's multiple possible glucoses. This is the one you built, though, because you didn't wrap it around into a ring. This is the so-called linear version. All of these are linear versions of the monosaccharide. In slide 3, though, you can see that any given linear monosaccharide can be bent and formed into a ring. So a monosaccharide exists either as a linear form or a ringed form, also called a cyclic form. You didn't actually do that, but you can see it happening right here. This linear form is being bent, but to complete the ring, which is made of bonds all the way around, if you think about how you would do this with your kits. You can't complete the ring unless you take a piece off of each end so that you can sew them together, right? Well, notice that that involves the carbonyl. Right now, that's a double bond, two of the four that carbon is making. You have to leave an empty hole in the carbon, though, if you're going to sew it together with this oxygen. And you also have to leave an empty hole in the oxygen. So this blue hydrogen has to be taken out, and this double bond has to turn into a single bond. That will allow the C and the O to complete the ring here. So every monosaccharide exists either in linear form or in ringed form, but notice that if it is in ringed form, it does not contain a carbonyl group, only in the linear form. Also notice the double arrows for this. This is completely reversible. And actually, if a monosaccharide is by itself, meaning it's not part of a bigger molecule, then this happens many, many times per second. It just keeps flipping back and forth between linear and ringed form. That's important, though, in a discussion of polysaccharides, which we're getting to, because of something we see in slide 4. We still don't see any polysaccharides here. They're not big enough yet to qualify as polysaccharides. But we are joining at the top here two glucoses, each by itself a monosaccharide, joining those to make maltose, which is a disaccharide, a two-part sugar. And importantly, to do that, not just for this example, any time that you're going to join two monosaccharides together, whether you're going to stop at two or build even bigger structure and become a polymer, if you're going to join two monosaccharides together, they have to be in the ringed form, not the linear form. Which is why you have the ringed forms of glucose right here. And notice that this follows the pattern that we saw on the first slide. One of the pieces has an OH somewhere. The other piece has an H somewhere. Those get removed to make water, allowing for the two to get hooked together. with a covalent bond. And if you're talking specifically, which we are here, about, well, this is a dehydration reaction, right? Which in general builds bigger things out of smaller by hooking them together. But if the two things that you're hooking together with a dehydration reaction are specifically monosaccharides, then we give that particular bond the name glycosidic linkage. And glyco is a root that means sugar. All right? In this case, we use two identical glucoses to make the specific disaccharide maltose, or malt sugar. But you don't have to use the same monosaccharides. You can mix and match. So glucose and fructose, for instance, are being hooked together the same exact way, but with different monosaccharides, to form a different disaccharide, sucrose, which we know as table sugar. And there's all kinds of other disaccharides as well, because there are different monosaccharides possible. Same process. You still call it a glycosidic linkage, but the final product depends on which monomers you use, right? Now, while we're still on this slide, let me point out that this OH and this H, which are involved in the dehydration, are not the only OH and H available on these, right? There's other places where you could do the same thing, meaning that a single monosaccharide could make multiple glycosidic linkages with different other monosaccharides, which means that the bigger thing could branch. You see that? The other two polymers, which are proteins and nucleic acids, that's not true for. They do not branch at all. They're just end-to-end arrangements. And a polysaccharide could be just an end-to-end arrangement. It doesn't have to branch, but because it has multiple connection points possible for glycosidic linkages, it can branch. Well, this still is not a polysaccharide. Kind of a word game when you finally have enough to qualify as poly. You just quit using words like we use trisaccharide as well for three, but when it gets bigger than that, we usually just say polysaccharide, but poly means many, whatever many is. Anyway, we're finally getting a look at a true polysaccharide, or actually two different ones here in slide five, three different ones. The ones on the left are starch. The ones on the right is glycogen. These are all examples of one category of polysaccharide. Polysaccharides come in or can be classified into two functional categories, meaning based on how they work, what they do. And those two categories are storage polysaccharides and structural polysaccharides. Storage polysaccharides are built for the purpose of storing energy for later use. And that's why, that makes sense when you realize, if you don't already, that monosaccharides are important fuels. They're the most important fuels in cells. And specifically, glucose, which is just one kind of monosaccharide, is the master fuel for all cells, not just your cells, all organisms. Chiefly use glucose as the fuel. In your own body, glucose is almost the only thing that your brain is able to use as fuel, whereas the rest of your body can use other things as well. But anyway, it's an important fuel, glucose. Whether it's glucose or some other monosaccharide, though, those can be used as fuel. When they're hooked together, they can't be used as fuel. So starch and glycogen are not fuels because you can't directly burn those. But both starch and glycogen are made out of nothing but glucoses to start with that are then hooked together. So they have a lot of energy in them as long as you can dismantle them into individual glucoses, which can then be used as fuel. And that's why they're called storage polysaccharides. Well, the plant version of this is starches. All of these individual green hexagons is a glucose. When we animals do it, it's arranged a little bit differently. It's still pure glucose, as far as the monomers are concerned, but our version is glycogen. It's an important function of your liver to make glycogen. We take in, as animals, you know, we're not just continuously and slowly taking in nutrients. We take in a huge batch of nutrients when we eat, right? And then after that's dissolved outside of our body and then absorbed through the intestines, that means shortly after a meal we get a huge spike in glucose, which would send our blood glucose level spiking, which could be dangerous. Well, we don't waste that extra energy. We want it for later. We just don't need it at the moment. So the liver takes the glycogen, takes the glucose out of the blood, hooks them together into a more compact form. This is why we do it, because remember, every one of these little bonds involves dehydration. So you can take a lot of water out of it and store a bunch of glucose more compactly that way for later use. But that keeps the blood glucose level normal. Hours after you've eaten, it's been since you've eaten, it's going to dip because your brain is continuously using glucose or you're dead. And if it gets low, that's dangerous too, especially for your brain. And so the liver just reverses the process. The glycogen it made earlier, it's just going to dismantle by hydrolysis reactions, the opposite of the dehydration reactions it used to build it to begin with. And that's going to turn the glycogen back into individual glucoses, which it puts into the blood, keeping your brain and therefore you alive. Plants do a similar thing, but they store their extra as starch. And really, the big difference between that and glycogen is in the degree of branching. Starches can be either not branching at all or just slightly branching. We animals have extensive branching in our storage polysaccharides. And the reason for that, by the way, is that the more branches you have, the more tips you have, and each tip can be simultaneously stripped of glucose individually. So it's much quicker to get a bunch of glucose out of glycogen in a given amount of time, which is important for animals, which things happen more quickly in than plants. Anyway, that's storage polysaccharides. In 6, we see the same storage polysaccharide, starch, on the left, but we see an example of the other major category, which is structural polysaccharides. Structural polysaccharides are not built for the purpose of getting energy later. They are, as the name implies, built to serve as structural components. But it's still glucose, usually, that you build. It's monosaccharides, but usually glucose. It is definitely glucose in the case of cellulose, which is the most abundant structural polysaccharide on Earth because there are so many plants building it. Well, this string of glucoses is going to be kept in that form. It's not going to be dismantled later for energy. It's serving as a little string, basically, which you can have a bunch of side by side and make a rope out of the little individual fibers, which do a good job at resisting tensile forces, things that we're trying to pull on. This brings up the fact that not only do monosaccharides exist in either linear or ringed form, but they can have multiple ringed forms. So these are both ringed forms of glucose, but one is alpha glucose and one is beta glucose. And this is because of what we talked about for enantiomers. You remember what those are? They are chiral compounds, right? They're chiral isomers. You remember the picture with the two hands that also right by them had the two tetrahedrons with carbon in the middle? When do you have chirality with respect to the carbon? What has to be true? Yes, but when does? What's the only way for that to happen with respect to the carbon in the middle? For instance, a methane and another methane are mirror images of each other, but they're not chiral. Right? They're actually the same molecule. For it to be chiral, the carbon has to be connected to four different things. That's the only way there's going to be a right and a left version. And that's true for alpha glucose and beta glucose. When you have these, you know, zigzags or these ring form, anytime you have the end of a line or a bend in a line and it's not labeled as something else like this O, then that is a carbon. So there's a carbon here. And notice it's connected to four different things. Right? So it's just like one of those tetrahedrons in that picture I showed you, meaning there's a left-handed version and a right-handed version. Well, the only difference between these two glucoses is that the H and the OH have switched positions in the other one. But that's permanent, right? Because those are covalent bonds. Well, if you use a bunch of alpha glucoses, hook them together, you make starch, storage polysaccharide. If you use a bunch of beta glucoses, it's still glucose, but a different version, you make cellulose, a structural polysaccharide. 7 shows you what I was talking about before. Each strand here of this rope is one enormously long molecule of cellulose made up of many, many glucoses hooked together with glycosidic linkages. Each one has a certain tensile strength, but when you band them together in parallel, like strands of a rope, you have an overall very strong structure. And this is found not just in cell walls, but the chief component of cell walls, which is a covering that all plant cells have that animal cells don't, is made of cellulose. So it's a hugely abundant polysaccharide in nature because, you know, there's so much wood and plant cells. Now, speaking of that, in slide 8, we have a cow eating grass, and grass as a plant contains much cellulose. It doesn't have to be a woody plant. Any plant has a lot of cellulose because every single cell in that plant has a cell wall made out of cellulose. And cellulose, as I just showed you, is really nothing but glucose, right? And glucose is the master fuel, so cellulose has the potential to be a rich source of monosaccharides that can be used as fuel, but not for animals, including us. We eat quite a bit of cellulose because anything you eat from a plant contains some, but we don't get any nutrition from that because it never enters our body because we don't have the ability as animals to break the glycosidic linkages in cellulose to turn it into small enough particles to absorb into our body. We can't digest it, in other words. So it just passes through us. Now, that's an important function also, but we don't get any nutrition from it. It's just considered roughage, fiber. Well, that's true for the ant, for the cow here, too. This is a fellow mammal. Very similar to humans in a lot of ways, including that it is not able to digest it. It is eating fiber, but it is getting nutrition from it. The reason that we can't digest it is because breaking those glycosidic linkages requires a specific enzyme, and enzymes are proteins. And remember that any given organism, including you, is stuck with what kinds of proteins it's able to make, because no cell can make a protein unless it has instructions for how to build it, which is what your genes are. So we don't have the gene that tells the cell how to build the specific protein that can break the glycosidic linkages between glucoses that make up cellulose. And neither does the cow as a fellow mammal. But he gets nutrition from it, or she does, depending on the sex, because in one of its stomachs, it houses trillions of bacteria which do have the gene necessary to form that enzyme to break those linkages. And this is an example, by the way, of symbiosis, which is more of a Bio 182 topic. Osis means condition. Bi, as in biology, means life. And sim means together. So a symbiosis is a situation of two species living closely together, which can happen in a lot of ways. Even more specifically than that, this is an example of endosymbiosis, endo meaning within, because one species lives inside the other. Now, that doesn't have to be good for both species involved. For instance, a parasite lives in something else that benefits the parasite, but not the host. But in this case, it benefits both, which is why it qualifies ecologically as mutualism. They both benefit. The bacteria benefit because they are given a nice, safe place to live with constant conditions, temperature and moisture, and a continuous supply of food. Yeah.
So, endosymbiosis is...
Endosymbiosis
is between the bacteria and the species.
Right, right, because the bacterium is living inside the cow.
Yeah, and that's what helps it.
Well, that's the only thing that allows it to break down. But it benefits the bacteria, obviously. And the bacteria are not trying to help the cow out, of course, right? They're just eating. But since they're able to break the cellulose into individual glucoses, the cow also benefits because it will absorb some of that glucose instead of allowing the bacteria to eat it. I mean, use it as energy. Now, slide 9 shows you that it's not only plants that make structural polysaccharides. Animals can do it as well, including insects, which construct their exoskeletons out of a structural polysaccharide called chitin, which is pretty tough stuff. Insects are unlike us. We have endoskeletons, hard inner parts, soft outer parts surrounding those. It's just the opposite for an insect. Their body is soft, so they need basically plate mail, outside armor, which is made of this polysaccharide chitin, and we take advantage of the strength of that, for instance, to make surgical thread. Strong stuff. Okay, that's a brief overview of polysaccharides, one of the four categories. Now it's on to lipids. And starting the lipids section, we'll talk about fats. I want to repeat that you should not use the words fat and lipid interchangeably. There's multiple versions of both of those, so they're both sets. There's different kinds of fats, and there's different kinds of lipids, but lipids is a bigger set. Fats is a subset of lipids. All fats are lipids, but not all lipids are fats, which is why they're not interchangeable. But we're starting with fats here. Well, actually, the bottom is the only place you see a fat here. The one on the top is not yet a fat. But a fat can go by any of three interchangeable words. I might have given you these before, but fat is one of them. You can also call a fat a triglyceride. And you can also call it a triacyl glycerol. Triglyceride is what most biologists would call it, and most biochemists would call it a triacyl glycerol. Most people that don't want to spell either one of those would call it a fat. But even though fat is easier to say and spell, it doesn't really tell you much about what it is. The word doesn't. These both start with tri, referring to these three orange pieces that are on it. And the glycerol part of triacyl glycerol points out that the other part, besides these three orange pieces, is a glycerol molecule, which is not this whole top thing. It's just the part that is shaded in tan, or ecru, or whatever color this is. This, if you ignore this orange part, this is a glycerol, which is a molecule in its own right, if that's all there is. What kind of molecule is glycerol that you know just by its name? Or that you should know just by its name? What does the name glycerol tell you about its chemistry? or about its makeup. It's an alcohol, right? It ends in OL. What needs to be true for it to be an alcohol? What makes any alcohol an alcohol? It has to have at least one hydroxyl. Well, glycerol has three hydroxyls, so it's triply an alcohol. And because of those three hydroxyls, each of which has a hydrogen, there's three connection points that this glycerol can make with the orange pieces. The orange pieces individually are called fatty acids. So a fat, or triglyceride or triacylglycerol, is a glycerol molecule that has been bonded to three individual fatty acids. Notice the same pattern here. It's a dehydration reaction to form these bonds between fatty acid and glycerol, right? The glycerol loses an H, the fatty acid loses an OH, out comes water, you can sew the two together. Now, ignore the glycerol now and look at just a fatty acid beside it, which is also, if that's all there is, a full molecule unto itself. So if you look at just this one fatty acid at the top, what can you tell me about it? What's there at the left end?
Double covalency with the oxygen there at the end.
There is no carbonyl group here. It is a carboxyl group. Remember, it looks like a carbonyl and a hydroxyl, but the whole thing is a carboxyl. So that's true of any fatty acid. There's a carboxyl at one end. And if you didn't have that carboxyl, but you still had the rest of the fatty acid, how would you categorize it? Just ignore the carboxyl. What would you, if all you had is the rest of it, what would it be? It would be a hydrocarbon. The whole rest of the fatty acid, other than the carboxyl, is nothing but carbons and hydrogens. And what did I say is important about hydrocarbons? Several things, but what was one thing I said is really important about hydrocarbons in general? Not just for biology. Also industrially.
Fuels.
Right, they are excellent fuels. So I just a little bit ago told you that glucose is the master fuel for all cells. It's what's used most often. But fats, because of these fatty acids being mostly hydrocarbon, even though technically not hydrocarbon, have much higher energy density. The energy density of substance is how much energy, usable energy, is in 1 gram of that stuff. And so there's three major nutrient classes from the food that we eat, which are carbohydrates, proteins, and fats. Fats have more than twice the energy density than either of the other two do. And this is exactly why we store our extra energy. If we take in more than our body needs, we store it as fat, whether it came in as anything else or as fat, right? We take in sugar from candy, for instance, and the label will say no fat, like they're bragging. But if it's more than you need, you're going to turn it into fat in your body to store it, because that's a lot more efficient. Because you can store more than twice the energy in a gram of that than you can with proteins or carbohydrates. If we stored them that way, as proteins or carbohydrates, we would have to use more than twice the material. We would weigh a lot more to carry that same amount of energy. Okay, so that's important about a fatty acid. Fatty acids can be used as fuel as well, and fats have three fatty acids each. But this is exactly the same dehydration reaction that's occurring between monosaccharides that we just looked at, except when it's monosaccharides that are linked that way, we call it a glycosidic linkage. When it's a fatty acid binding to one part of the glycerol, we call that bond an ester linkage. So there's three ester linkages in one fat or triglyceride. Now, before we leave this, let me say that this is just one fat of many possible fats. Fats are not identical. But all glycerols are identical. There's only one kind of glycerol. Therefore, if there's only one kind of glycerol, but there's multiple kinds of fats, what does that imply? What must be true? Must be true that there's different kinds of fatty acids, right? Since all glycerols are the same. And that's true. This particular example happens to have the same exact fatty acid for all three of the places. It doesn't have to be true. This just happens to be one. But there's two major ways in which fatty acids can differ from each other. Try to imagine one way just by looking at these. What could be different about this fatty acid and still have it be a fatty acid? To be a fatty acid, it needs a carboxyl and then a hydrocarbon tail. How could it be different? Yes, that is the second reason. But what I was hoping someone would come up first is that there's nothing saying that you have to stop here, right? The length can be different. If you're building this out of balls and sticks, you didn't have to put a hydrogen here. You could have kept this pattern going, right? Or you could have stopped it here with another hydrogen. So the length of the hydrocarbon chain can differ from fatty acid to fatty acid. That's one way. And that way alone allows for different fats, because the same fat can have three of the same, two of the same, and one different, or all three different lengths. That makes them different fats just for that reason. Okay? That's just one way, though. There's another fundamentally different way in which fatty acids can differ from each other, explained in slide 11. Those two ways give rise to the two categories, which are, these apply not only to fats, but primarily to fatty acids. There are fatty acids that are called saturated fatty acids and unsaturated fatty acids. When you think about the word saturated, just in everyday use, what's a good synonym for that? Yes, filled. I'm going to temporarily, just because it's easier to show you, go back to slide 10 to show you these carbon skeletons and the hydrogens that make up the most of the tail. These are all, well, they're all identical in this case. This version of a fatty acid, notice, has only single bonds in its carbon skeleton. Nothing but single carbon-carbon bonds, right? If you think once again about your molecular modeling, or imagine making this, any one of these carbons in the middle of the chain has two bonds it's making with the carbons on either side. That leaves two holes open, right? So you fill those with hydrogen. If a fatty acid has only single bonds between its carbons, then that's going to be the maximum number of possible holes that you can fill with hydrogen, right? In other words, having only single bonds in a fatty acid means that it is saturated with hydrogen. That's why it got that name. If you make only one double bond, you've still reduced the number of hydrogens, right? Because you're going to have to take hydrogen from each of the carbons in order to make a double bond. So it won't hold as many hydrogens, and therefore, if it has one or more double bonds in the fatty acid, then it is unsaturated. It's not holding as many hydrogens as possible. So those are names that define fatty acids. Any given fatty acid individually is either a saturated or unsaturated. But we use the names correspondingly for fats as well. A saturated fat is one that is made out of only saturated fatty acids. They don't have to be the same fatty acid in their length, but all three have to be saturated. All it takes is just one fatty acid being unsaturated to make the fat that it's part of unsaturated. But notice that also that there are degrees of unsaturatedness. One double bond is enough to qualify it as unsaturated, but there can be multiple double bonds. And that's why on food labels you see saturated fats, unsaturated fats, polyunsaturated fats, meaning multiple double bonds holding even fewer hydrogens. Well, the major point about that's being portrayed in this slide is that saturation or unsaturatedness affects the shape. If all you have are single bonds and a saturated fatty acid, then the zigzag is a straight line. Or the zigzag does not bend, I should say. The zigzag itself is not straight, but there's no kink in it. But any place where you have a double bond is going to form a bend in that zigzag shape. And therefore, unsaturated fatty acids don't fit together as closely with each other as saturated fatty acids do. I usually use the analogy of representing fatty acids with stiff pieces of wire. You can have different lengths of them, which fatty acids can vary in their length, right? But if all you have are unbent wires, then they will pack together in a box very nicely. Just like molecules in a solid are closer to each other than they are in a liquid. If you have a bunch of them that are bent, though, which would be unsaturated fatty acids, and especially if those bends are at different positions in each length, and you throw them into the box, there's going to be a lot of space between them, right? They don't pack together. So that's why animals, which produce primarily saturated fats, have fat products that are more solid than liquid, like butter. Plants, on the other hand, make mostly unsaturated fats, and therefore theirs are more liquid at room temperature, like oils. What were you going to ask?
No, you answered it.
Oh, you sure?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, that's fats. That brings us to 12, which is a similar structure that we're looking at here. This is a different kind of lipid. Looks kind of like a fat, but importantly, there are some differences. This is a phospholipid that we're looking at. Obviously a type of lipid based on its name. And it is truly impossible to overstate the importance of phospholipids to life. There simply would not be any life without phospholipids. What is the structural requirement, the structural unit of life? The cell. And the cell is defined by what structure? No, not all cells have nuclei. Most don't. The plasma membrane, that's what the boundary of the cell is, the plasma membrane, right? That's how you know you're looking at a cell, by its boundary. And all of life, which is all of the chemical reactions that occur within cells, not outside of cells. All right? Well, as we'll see, a phospholipid is made mostly out of a plasma membrane of any cell that's ever existed is made mostly out of phospholipids. I'll say why in a minute. But first, let's look at the structure. Why it's similar to a fat is that there is a glycerol involved, just like for a triglyceride or fat. That, remember, has three connection points. Well, two of those connection points are used, just like in a fat, to connect two fatty acids. But the third one, instead of being a third fatty acid, is connected to a phosphate group in yellow. And if you don't remember, you can look at this picture to see that a phosphate group has a charge on one of its oxygens. Well, that makes it even beyond polar, right? Polar is a partial charge. A full charge is even beyond that. So that's what makes this such a special molecule. It's an example of an amphipathic molecule. The pathic part of that refers to feeling, like empathy and sympathy. Amphi means what? Do you know any other words with amphi in them? Amphibian is a perfect example because bi, as in biosis or biology, means life once again. Amphi means dual or both. An amphibian gets its name because it has a dual lifestyle. Spends part of its life on earth, on land, part of it on in the water. And very similarly, an amphitheater, partly outdoors, partly indoors. Well, amphipathic means having dual feeling or dual preference, in a sense. Now, of course, the molecule doesn't have feeling or preference, but that's why it's named. An amphipathic molecule is one that has part of its structure that is polar and another part of its of that same molecule nonpolar. And you can see why for a phospholipid, which is a specific example of an amphipathic molecule. The fatty acids are mostly hydrocarbon for their tails, right? Hydrocarbons are nonpolar in general, because carbon and hydrogen have roughly equal electronegativities. That makes them polar compounds, and polar compounds do not like, Nonpolar compounds don't like to be around polar compounds, they like to be around other nonpolar ones. The phosphate has a charge in the head, and in the cartoon version of phospholipids, it's always drawn as a circular head with two tails. In that circular head, you have phosphate, which makes it charged. That's even beyond polar, right? So the head has no problem being around other polar stuff, doesn't want to be around nonpolar stuff. Has dual preference in the same molecule, in other words. And the reason that's so important to life, as I said, is that this is how the first cells and all cells since formed. Slide 13 shows you not a cell, but if you have pure water, no life in it, and just millions of phospholipids, no life, they're just molecules, and you put those phospholipids into the pure water, they will automatically and immediately self-assemble into a sphere made out of two layers, a so-called phospholipid bilayer. Two monolayers, one monolayer here, one monolayer here, but in three dimensions that would be a bag of two layers. And therefore there would be water on the inside and water on the outside. Without any life, so this is how the original cells got their shape. The reason it happens, though, is simply because these are amphipathic molecules, and the hydrophobic tails, I should have mentioned those two words before in slide 12. Corresponding to polar, we have the word hydrophilic, which means water-loving. Corresponding to nonpolar, we have the word hydrophobic, water-fearing. All right, so there's both in one phospholipid, and that's why they get together like in slide 13. The hydrophobic tails are simply trying to avoid water. The only way to do that is to put themselves in this arrangement. The hydrophilic polar heads have no problem being around water. That's where they want to be. So this forms a boundary between the rest of the universe and the watery environment inside this bag. This is not a cell, and it's not a complete plasma membrane, but it's how the first cells came into existence, even before they were alive. The reason this isn't a complete plasma membrane is because when this forms, this would allow certain things through it, but not others. Some of those things that are blocked need to get into or out of cells. So we'll see a lot of examples in the next chapter. And therefore, a complete plasma membrane is not pure phospholipids. It's mostly phospholipids, and there's other things in there as well, like proteins that allow certain things through that wouldn't get through otherwise. Now to 14. Still in lipids, this is another important lipid. We saw a similar slide in a previous chapter with two molecules that looked very similar to this. Do you remember what those were? Yeah, they were steroid hormones. There was estradiol and estrogen, and there was testosterone. Almost identical to this, very similar. I mean, they have the same ring structure. And even though those are different steroid hormones with drastically different effects, they all start out as this chemical, which then gets modified to make not only estrogen and testosterone, but all the steroid hormones and other things as well. In animals, this is cholesterol, which is, to an animal, completely indispensable. We can't live without cholesterol, even though it has a bad reputation because of the association with buildup of plaque, but we wouldn't exist without it to begin with. Not only does it serve as a precursor to all the steroid hormones in animals, but it also is an important component of plasma membranes, and it also serves as a precursor for vitamin D, which is kind of unusual for a vitamin. Vitamins get their name because they're absolutely vital. We cannot live without them, but most vitamins are classified as vitamins because we don't have the cellular machinery to make them, even though we require them, which means we absolutely have to get them from organisms that can make them. In other words, our food. It's usually bacteria that make the vitamins. Vitamin D is an exception, though, because we can make vitamin D starting with cholesterol. Cholesterol in our skin gets struck by UV rays from the sun, and that changes the structure of cholesterol, makes it into something called cholecalciferol, which then travels to the liver, gets hydroxylated. Another hydroxyl beyond the one that's there already gets added, and so that makes it a double alcohol. Cholesterol is an alcohol, right? It ends in OL because of that hydroxyl. Anyway, the liver adds a second hydroxyl. That makes it into something called calcidiol. Diol means it's a double alcohol. Then it goes to the kidneys that adds another hydroxyl to make it calcitriol, which is the active form of vitamin D. Then it travels to the small intestine where it does its major job as vitamin D, which is to greatly help out in the absorption of calcium from whatever's in your food. We don't do a very good job of absorbing calcium, which is absolutely vital also, unless we have vitamin D. So truly important for us to live as animals. Now, a vegan, which I am an example of, takes in no cholesterol at all in the diet because plants don't make it and fungi don't make it. Animals make it. But that doesn't mean I have zero level of cholesterol, right? Why is that? Because I am an animal, yes. The reason that animals that you use as food have it is because they are animals. They need it to survive. Well, so do I. I make my own. So do you, all of you. And you just, if you eat animals, you take in more than what you already make. Plants have similar sterols, but it's not cholesterol. Those are called phytosterols, which literally means plant sterol. Phyto means plant. Coal, by the way, is another word for bile. The ol means it's an alcohol. Stare, as in stereo, means solid, three-dimensional. And coal means bile. So cholesterol literally means bile, solid alcohol. It is a major component of the mixture of stuff we call bile that's produced by the liver and put into the gallbladder. Anyway, plants don't make it. They make phytosterols, and fungi make ergosterols, which have similar functions, but they are different molecules. Okay, that is lipids. Now we're going to go into the proteins section. So lipids, remember, were not polymers. They're macromolecules, but not polymers. Polysaccharides that we started with were polymers. Proteins are also polymers. But they're different from polysaccharides in what you use as monomers or building blocks to build them. So for polysaccharides, the monomers are what? What are the monomers called?
Glucose.
Well, that's one example. It doesn't have to be glucose.
Monosaccharides,
right. Proteins are made of different monomers. Anyone know what those are? Those are amino acids. Completely different molecules from monosaccharides, but when you hook a bunch of amino acids together, you get a polypeptide, which sometimes is interchangeable with the word protein, but not always. I'll explain why in a different lecture. But for now, I'm going to roughly use protein and polypeptide as interchangeable. Well, anyway, polypeptides or proteins do all the important jobs in cells. Now, yes, it's true that you cannot survive if you don't have any one of the four macromolecule classes. You have to have all four. They all do important things. But in terms of the individual things that are happening in cells moment to moment, every tiny thing involves a protein somehow. And you can see that reflected in this table. Now, usually I don't read tables to you, because you can read them yourself and they're usually just summaries. But I'll spend a little bit of time on this table, even though maybe not today. Because this is not really a summary. We haven't talked about this. What I want you to notice, though, right now, before we're about to end, is that you can see a long list of functions here. These are not even specific functions. These are categories of functions. And there's many, many examples of each category. But not only is, you can see just from the list that proteins have a hugely long list of functions, but also a hugely diverse set of functions. These functions are completely different from each other. And this is why I keep saying that proteins are what really give you your traits, because they're the things actually doing things in your cell. They are allowing things to happen. And your genes indirectly give you your traits, because your genes tell your cells which kinds of proteins it's able to build. You're stuck with those, that set, unless you genetically engineer yourself. Which you could do, for instance, to add the ability to digest cellulose. If you had that gene, then you could eat paper and get nutrition from it. But anyway, all of these functions, as diverse as they are, they all are possible individually. Each one is possible. Specifically because of the shape of the protein that does that function. So shape and function are inextricably linked in proteins. Any given protein is able to do whatever it can do, specifically, because of its particular shape. And the reason that proteins, as a category of molecules, has such a huge diversity of functions is because there's effectively no limit to the number of shapes you can make with proteins because of how the way they're put together. And so that's why they, just by accident, you know, every time you have a genetic mutation, which just happens in nature, a change in the DNA, that's going to make a corresponding change to a protein. It's going to have slightly different shape. And so over long times, when this just happens accidentally, some of these accidents actually make a protein that works differently and sometimes even better than ones that had existed already. And this is what natural selection operates on. Those better versions will be favored because it'll give the organism a better chance of surviving. That's why we have different traits, but we end up having different traits. But we'll end a little bit early today, and because this kind of keeps us even with all my other sections, easier to remember what slide to turn to and start with.